It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. European leaders to consider a new migrant quota system. European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker is expected to unveil a country-by-country two-year quota plan Wednesday as the continent struggles to cope with a massive influx of economic migrants and refugees from the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. The plan could cover as many as 160,000 people, with Germany, France, and Spain taking the most. Donald Tusk is the European Council President, speaking Tuesday in Jerusalem.
Europe is focused for rescuing people's lives. This is the most important goal for us. And as a consequence of this point of view, it's also our fight against human traffickers and smugglers.
The UN warned Tuesday as many as 850,000 asylum seekers could reach Europe this year and next. In Washington, U.S. officials are considering a change in their response after taking in some 1,500 Syrian refugees since the conflict began in 2011. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
No decisions have been made about future resettlement going, you know, past this fiscal year, but I do think it's reasonable to expect and to assume that there will be additional resettlements going into next year. What that's going to look like, how many, I don't have a number for you.
A coalition of U.S. religious groups Tuesday urged the government to take in as many as 100,000 Syrian migrants over the next year. In Sierra Leone, at least three more patients testing positive for Ebola in the north. It follows the death of a 67-year-old woman of the deadly virus in August. The National Ebola Response Center says it expects more cases to be identified. One village of 1,000 is in the midst of a three-week quarantine. The death of the woman last month came less than a week after the last person previously confirmed to have Ebola was released from the hospital. This is VOA News. The United States Tuesday said it's considering ways to remedy problems in the train-and-equip program for moderate Syrian rebels who are going up against the Islamic State. Defense spokesman Peter Cook offered no details on changes to the $500 million program, but says Defense Secretary Ashton Carter believes it's the right strategy to confront the IS group.
Local forces are going to decide this fight against ISIL in large measure, and that has not changed. The Secretary still believes that it's important to provide support to those moderate Syrian forces. We've seen, and the Secretary has been candid about what happened initially with the train and equip program. We've learned lessons from that, continue to learn lessons from that, and we're going to continue moving forward with that program.
He acknowledged failures when the first group of 54 recruits inserted into Syria in July were attacked and decimated by the al-Nusra Front, an affiliate of al-Qaeda. A Saudi-led air campaign struck Yemen's capital Sana'a and Marib province, aiming at Shia Houthi rebels following last Friday's missile strike by rebels that killed 60 coalition troops. There are various casualty figures, with accounts saying both rebels and civilians were killed. Debate is underway in the U.S. Congress on the international nuclear agreement with Iran. Supporters say they've gained 41 Democratic senators, enough to block a resolution that opposes the deal. This means President Obama may not have to veto the measure. Minority Leader Harry Reid's among those backing the agreement.
Is the agreement between Iran and the international community, led by the United States, the best pathway to peace and security for America, Israel, our partners, and interests? I believe the answer is unquestionably yes.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney, speaking in Washington Tuesday, is a vocal opponent of the deal.
They have placed on the table for congressional review a deal that provides weapons and funds to a regime that has pledged to destroy Israel and maintains death to America as a central pillar of its policies.
The agreement is designed to contain Tehran's nuclear program in return for an easing of international sanctions. The United Nations says civilian deaths in war-ravaged eastern Ukraine have surged since May, pushing the death toll in the 17-month pro-Russian rebellion to nearly 8,000. Nearly 18,000 others have been wounded. Former Zimbabwean Vice President Joyce Mujuru Tuesday released a political manifesto in a possible sign she intends to challenge long-serving President Robert Mugabe. She was once seen as a possible successor to Mr. Mugabe until being sacked by him in December. The Minnesota dentist who killed Zimbabwe's famed Cecil the Lion returned to work Tuesday after spending weeks avoiding the public eye. In July, Walter Palmer killed the rare black-maned lion who was being tracked with a GPS collar as part of an Oxford University project. Palmer said he and the other hunters in the party had no clue the lion was protected. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Who killed yet another Burundian opposition politician?
You have to remember that almost every day there are dead bodies that are found in some areas of the capital city, Bujumbura. And what is really sad and hard to understand is some of these people who are found dead were arrested previously by the police.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the banned Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. Guinea-Bissau's Supreme Court will rule today, Wednesday, on the constitutionality of the Prime Minister's dismissal. And three more people have tested positive for Ebola in Sierra Leone.
These are people who stay in the same community because, of course, when the woman died, neither do they know that it was Ebola. So most of them visited home, and some even participated in washing of the corpses. So that is why the entire village was actually quarantined.
Dr. Brian Makabo is the chief medical officer of Sierra Leone. Years after Nigeria's civil war, some Biafrans still agitate for separation. Former Zimbabwe Vice President Joyce Mujuru unveils a manifesto. And the United Nations says child mortality has dropped dramatically. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Another opposition politician has been killed in Burundi, the latest in a string of murders following President Pierre Nkurunziza's re-election for a controversial third term. The police said Patrice Gahungu, spokesman of the Union for Peace and Democracy, the UPDE, was shot dead by unidentified people as he arrived home late on Monday evening. This followed the shooting death of UPD President Zedi Faruzi in May. An exiled UPD official has accused the government of being behind the killing of Gahungu, but a police source said Gahungu may have been killed by the opposition because he had publicly congratulated President Nkurunziza for his controversial re-election. Innocent Muhozi, general manager of the banned Independent Renaissance Radio, says the shocking thing is that the government has not tried to seriously investigate the killings.
Almost every day, there's someone who's killed. The last one is this spokesman of UPDZ, Gamibanga. You must remember that more or less 2 months ago, the president of the same party has been killed by people in uniforms of the police, and that there has been no investigation at all to find who killed this man. Now it's the spokesman of the same political party. But you have to remember also that almost every day, there are dead bodies that are found in some areas of the capital city, Bujumbura. And what is really sad and hard to understand is some of these people who are found dead were arrested previously by the policeman. So no one understands how come people who have been arrested by policemen in some jails around the capital city are found dead in places in the capital city, Bujumbura. This is really a thing that is creating a lot of tension, a lot of fear, and a lot of anger against the state.
The deputy president of the Union for Peace and Democracy, whose spokesman was killed, we understand he himself is in exile. He's blaming the government. Is there a merit to that?
You know, almost everybody now thinks that it's the government that has killed this spokesman because most of these people are opposition people, even if there are no proofs. But what is really sad and make people think it's the government killing all these people is that there is no investigation, nothing serious is done to find out who are the killers. That's why people think that it's the government using police forces to kill all those people. It cannot be understandable to see that almost every day there are those dead bodies and that is not a single investigation.
What do you make of this information? This report is quoting a source from the police saying that perhaps the opposition might have killed this spokesman because he publicly congratulated President Pierre Nkurunziza on his controversial third-term election.
I'm not sure that this guy congratulated the government about what. Again, what is really difficult to understand is the fact that there have never been investigations, serious investigations, in any of those killings.
Where are things? Has President Nkurunziza, can we say that he has solidified his position after this election? Because at some point there was talk of this national unity government. Where are things now?
Yeah, the government, the president is in power now, and there have been some arrangements with one of the leaders of the opposition, Mr. Gafur Wasa, but this doesn't mean at all that the crisis is over, because as you can see, every day there are people who are killed, and you see these opposition leaders who are in the, outside the country meeting and again saying that they have to do anything that can be done to make President Nkurunziza leave the power. So except this arrangement with Mr. Wasa, Agathon Wasa, the situation is exactly the same as it was before these elections, where some say, okay, Nkurunziza have the right to be the president, and the other say they have got no right at all.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the band Independent Renaissance Radio of Burundi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Guinea-Bissau's Supreme Court is scheduled to rule today, Wednesday, on the constitutionality of President José Mario Vaz's decision last month to dismiss his prime minister. The new prime minister announced a new government on Monday. Vincent Foulcher, a researcher at the International Crisis Group, talked to Ricky Shryak about the political impasse in Guinea-Bissau and the importance of Wednesday's Supreme Court ruling.
The court will decide on the validity of the president's decision to remove the former prime minister, not on his decision to appoint a new prime minister. So if they annul the president's decision, then the former prime minister gets back in. But, you know, it's kind of, it's the first time, actually, that something like this happens, and it's kind of complicated.
What is the likelihood that they rule that he was legitimate in removing the former prime minister?
The constitution is kind of clear on the process through which the prime minister should be designated. He should be the president's party at the assembly to designate someone. And this is not what has been done for the new designation, and this is what was done for the former prime minister. So, you know, I think there's a legal argument, and there's a whole discussion about whether the country was in a situation of political crisis, which allowed for the president to go ahead with such a move. What is a political crisis? I mean, there's a whole legal debate about what that can be. So, you know, I really think it's not clear at this stage to say what the court is going to say. Also, because many of the court appointees obviously have political affiliations, are related to this or that party.
There is, on the one hand, they rule he was constitutional, and then possibly things just keep on going with this new government that's been formed. Or would ruling he was unconstitutional plunge the country further into a political quagmire?
If the court decides that this was an unconstitutional decision, it's not very clear how to follow from then.
Obviously, the decision has an effect on whether the current newly appointed government stays. And about that current and newly appointed government, the new 15 ministers and 15 secretaries, who are these guys coming in? Do they have experience? Do they have a reputation of being trustworthy?
It's a government in which the PRS, the second largest party, increases its presence, though it does not increase its presence by much. I mean, it's gaining a few more ministries and secretaries of state, but it's, my understanding is not as much as given their crucial part in making this new government possible at all.
Under Pereira, tax receipts had gone up quite a bit in Bissau, and then once Pereira was gone, they went back down. Do you think a new government would make the tax receipts hypothetically go back up again?
And there's an argument about that, because the new authorities are basically arguing, well, it's a seasonal matter, there's less money to be raised in the months of August and September. I don't know if I'm convinced by this explanation. It's true that the previous government was making a lot of interesting moves in terms of reforming the customs, checking customs receipts better and trying to deploy a scanner and other things. And I think that was very necessary and very welcome. You know, I guess we'll see if new government is able to get away with the same sort of effort.
That was Vincent Foulcher, a researcher with the International Crisis Group. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. Today's Wednesday, September 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Sierra Leone health authorities say three more people have tested positive for Ebola from the same village in the northern part of the country where a 67-year-old woman died last week from the virus. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Brahima Kabo says the three new patients came from among the 50 high-risk persons identified as close relatives of the deceased woman. Sierra Leone has had nearly 14,000 cases of Ebola and 4,000 deaths since the outbreak began. But Dr. Kabo says the latest outbreak is containable.
These are people who stay in the same community because, of course, when the woman died, neither do they know that it was Ebola. So most of them visited home, and some even participated in washing of the corpses. So that is why the entire village was actually quarantined to actually avoid transmitting the infection from one place to another. And the three positive cases were from the same household where the disease used to stay. So it is the same chain of transmission. We are still trying to actually ensure that we don't have another chain apart from this current chain of transmission that we have in Tela Kafta in Cambia district.
So, Dr. Kabo, say an ordinary Sierra Leonean may be concerned to say, wow, is Ebola coming back to Sierra Leone? What assurance can you give them?
Ebola is not coming back from Sierra Leone because now we can actually trace the origin of the infection. If it would have been from an unknown source, that would have been another matter. But this is from a source that is known in the same village, the same community. So that's not very easy for trace. And notwithstanding that also, we have actually vaccinated more than 130 people in that same community to actually protect them and also prevent them from actually getting the infection from presumably for those who may have come into contact with these individuals.
What can you tell us, Dr. Kabo? We also hear that the niece of this deceased lady who died from Ebola is also wanted, or you would like for her to come to be tested?
Yeah, well, the niece was positive. She was tested. She was the fourth person to become infected after the woman because she was the one taking care, more like the caregiver. She was the caregiver of this diseased woman. When the woman became very ill, she was very much instrumental in ensuring that she provided all the care to this particular woman, the niece in question, who became positive. So all those who became positive are those who are closely related to the diseased woman.
You know, because the government has made this kind of a criminal offense, is it not true that perhaps this girl or this lady might be afraid to come out because she's afraid something might happen that the government might put her in jail?
I don't think so. It's just the issue of the fear and panic on the issue of the Ebola. I don't think it's because of the government putting her in jail. Because normally what happens is that they have the bylaws at community level. And if it is true that she deliberately participated in the burial of the woman, then of course the local authorities will take appropriate action. But I don't think it's true that she ran away because the government takes punitive measures against her.
Dr. Kabo, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you always.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dr. Brian Kabo is the Chief Medical Officer of Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. It's been decades since Nigeria's southeast region tried to secede, renaming itself Biafra and sparking a civil war that left nearly a million people dead. Biafra is long gone, but some in the southeast are still agitating for separation. Christine reports with Hilary Uguru in Oba, Nigeria.
Since independence in 1960, Nigeria has seen periodic conflicts between the country's many ethnic groups. Perhaps none were as wrenching as the Civil War, which started in 1967 when the country's southeast, which is dominated by the Igbo people, seceded. Biafra didn't make it to its third birthday. But 45 years after it was reabsorbed into Nigeria, its name lives on among pressure groups who say they haven't benefited as citizens of Nigeria. Uchenna Madu is the media coordinator of the Movement for the Actualization of Sovereign States of Biafra, or MASOB.
The government of Nigeria, which are always run by the Hausa Fulanis or the Yorubas, are always using government policies against our people.
Madu is referring there to two of the other major ethnic groups in Nigeria. The continued agitation by supporters of Biafra in the southeast has unnerved Nigerian authorities. On Tuesday, the police announced they had arrested 22 people affiliated with MASOB and another pro-Biafra group for inciting violence. Ronnie Onwuka is a community leader in the town of Oba in the southeastern Anambra state. Despite the fact that President Muhammadu Buhari recently appointed an Igbo to head the state oil company, he says the agitation for Biafra stems from a feeling that the federal government doesn't care about the southeast or the Igbo people.
If we can be treated like this, why not we be alone? I call what you see a result of marginalization.
But with the Biafran War of the 1960s leaving a million dead and much of the southeast ravaged, the question remains, how far are Biafra supporters willing to go for independence? Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Former Zimbabwe Vice President Joyce Mujuru on Tuesday released a political manifesto that some say signals her desire to possibly run against her former boss, President Robert Mugabe. Sandra Nyaira of U.S. Zimbabwe Service has details.
Mrs. Mujuru introduced her proposal by explaining that her and her unnamed team have been hard at work, and I wish to share with you in brief how we propose to translate our vision for a better Zimbabwe into reality. The former vice president spelled out her vision, mission and strategy for a better Zimbabwe. The former vice president did not explain the vehicle through which build would be implemented, as the manifesto made no mention of her intention to run as president or to form a party under which she would contest. While she does not say who the we is in the document is replete with mentions of People First, a suggested name for a political party Zimbabweans are expecting her to launch ahead of the 2018 elections. Mrs. Mujuru, 60, says she will repeal laws such as the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act that bar foreign journalists from operating permanently in the country and has blocked the establishment of private television stations, while radio licenses have been issued to people with ZANU-PF links. Also on her list is the country's controversial indigenization laws that she says would be amended drastically, along with other laws that restrict the people's movement. She also said her government would provide title for land. Currently, all land in the country belongs to the state. Reporting from Washington, D.C., this is Sandra Nyaira.
Independent Zimbabwe political commentator Unshlala Dube says he's not surprised that former Vice President Joyce Mujuru may be laying the groundwork to challenge President Robert Mugabe.
Well, two things to consider, Chris. Quickly, firstly, the first thing to consider is that what she has done is nothing new. She obviously wanted to wrestle power from President Mugabe, from within ZANU-PF. She failed to do that. They were discovered, they were kicked out of ZANU-PF, as we all know. So that is part of history that we all know. But they didn't stop there. So obviously, their view about how Zimbabwe should be run, how Zimbabwe should be structured, is now continuing outside the confines of ZANU-PF as we know it.
What do you think is the way forward when we look at what has happened so far?
We know that she started by separating herself from ZANU-PF by issuing that statement, you remember, where she apologized to Zimbabwe for having been part of this government that has created all sorts of negative growth in society, in all sectors of society. Therefore, she was then putting herself at the mercy of Zimbabwe and saying, look, I'm here, yes, I know I've done things that are wrong, but I'm willing to apologize. Those that are still in ZANU-PF are not willing to apologize. So, and she has continued to create an image, a brand, which is brand in jewelry, if I can call it that, which shows a different ZANU-PF personality to the ZANU-PF that is still headed by President Mugabe.
That was Independent Zimbabwe political analyst Unshlala Dube speaking from Harare with Chris Gandhi of VOA Zimbabwe Service. New data show that mortality rates for children under 5 years old have fallen by more than half since 1990, when the Millennium Development Goals were established. Despite the huge success, the United Nations says most countries still have missed the MDG target of reducing child mortality by two-thirds. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey are sheltering more than 4 million Syrian refugees. European frontline states, in particular Italy and Greece, are shouldering the greatest burden arising from the influx of refugees from countries in the Middle East and elsewhere. This is not fair, says Peter Sutherland, the UN official in charge of migration. He says caring for refugees is not just the responsibility of the states bordering a conflict zone or the first countries of asylum where they arrive, but a global responsibility. He notes there has to be a similar international response to the current crisis as happened during the time of the 1956 Hungarian Revolution and the crisis of the Vietnamese boat people at the end of the 1970s. On both occasions, he says, there was a global acceptance of responsibility.
We have to find a method, perhaps as we did in 1956 in the conference that took place then, to get specific commitments from every state in regard to taking refugees, and financially contributing to dealing with the crisis which we now face.
Sutherland says he is disheartened that many European countries are blocking efforts to reach a unified effort to distribute refugees fairly among all 28 EU nations. He says the irony of Hungary's opposition to such a deal is not lost on him. Sutherland says all countries have an obligation to take a fair share of refugees. He says that includes the United States, Canada, Australia, those in Latin America, the Far East, and the Gulf Arab states, which he notes have taken in no refugees. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin at the All Africa Games in Brazzaville, Republic of Congo. Local fans cheered loudly when Innocent Okemba won men's Kumite 60-kilogram division in karate on Tuesday. This is the host country's first gold medal at the Games. Egyptians Ahmed Shwaki and Yassim Atia triumphed in men's kata and women's 55-kilogram Kumite contests. Algerian Camilia Manal, Said Haj, Lydia Besbes, and Abdel Latif Ben Khalid each clinched gold medals in women's kata, Kumite 50-kilogram division, and men's 67-kilogram Kumite divisions, respectively. At the end of the contest, Algeria topped the medal table with 3 gold, 2 silver, and 2 bronze medals. Egypt is second, followed by Republic of Congo, Botswana, as Gabon and Senegal share 5th place. South Africa is 7th, Mozambique 8th, while Cameroon and Libya share the 9th spot. Turning to the British Commonwealth Games in Apia, Samoa. In athletics, Botswana's Karabo Sibanda won boys 400 meters in a lifetime best of 45.83 seconds on Tuesday. His previous best was 46.03 seconds in the finals at the World Youth Championships in July. Nigeria's Idama Dudu Praise Ogenefejiro clinched a bronze medal in girls 400 meters. South African Renate Van Tonder and Ghanaian Richard Sekloru triumphed in girls and boys long jump, respectively. Nigeria won boys 4x200-meter relay, while Nigerian girls won both the 4x200-meters and 4x400-meter relays. In weightlifting, Nigerian Emmanuel Inemo clinched a gold medal in boys' 62-kilogram weightlifting division, while Lent Keti of Mauritius bagged a bronze medal in the girls' 53-kilogram division. Meanwhile, South Africa are second on the medal table as of Tuesday, with 7 gold, 3 silver, and 7 bronze medals. Nigeria is 7th, Kenya 8th, as Botswana and Ghana share 13th spot. Uganda is 16th, and Mauritius is 22nd out of 54 countries and territories that constitute the British Commonwealth. Finally, in volleyball, African champions Kenya pipped Peru by 3-2 as Russia dismissed Algeria in straight sets in the final matches at the World Women's Volleyball Championships in Japan. Kenya is 10th overall, while Algeria finished at the bottom of the 12-nation log. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The U.S. dentist who killed Zimbabwe's famed Cecil the Lion returned to work on Tuesday after spending weeks avoiding the public and media over his controversial hunt. Walter Palmer entered his Bloomington, Minnesota dental office on Tuesday morning, passing through a small crowd of protesters and reporters gathered out front. That is it for this Wednesday, September the 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Jim Harmon, I'm James Barton in Washington saying have a nice day, Africa.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.